When you have health insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. That's healthlock.com.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
By the way, the Supreme Court, 9-0, the ruling was let Donnie cook. Desi, Democrats have to be disappointed in this ruling.
Yes, Democrats are doing more shower crying than normal today, John. But they are still confident that a conviction in the January 6th trial can keep Trump out of the White House.
But Desi, that's seemingly not likely going to happen before Election Day.
Right. But fortunately, Trump has three other criminal trials coming up. One of those has to be a conviction, so Democrats are optimistic.
But Trump can still be president if he's convicted. I mean, none of the cases would stop that.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, John. Democrats say if none of these cases go their way, there is still another avenue to pursue.
The getting more votes scenario.
They were going to lay Reese's Pieces out in a trail that leads into a golden tent labeled Mar-a-Lago that can only be zipped from the outside.
I still think the more votes...
Democrats find a witch. The witch turns Donald Trump into a bird. The bird isn't there on Election Day, having already migrated to a warmer climate.
Hey, 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 this is Fan Boogie. I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And
welcome.
We are back for installment number 9. And we are going to be talking to an incredible filmmaking duo later on in the show. That was Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. And it's also, I think, kind of an interesting, an interesting example of a culture shift that is happening right now around Trump's... his rise to the GOP nomination. So, Jon Stewart, he gets it sometimes. The guy is funny. The guy is an unmistakable talent. And when you speak the truth, comedy comes out. Now, obviously, the guy is, kind of a hired hitman. And I think that's why he's been brought back to The Daily Show. For anyone that doesn't know, he's been brought back to The Daily Show. I think he's doing a kind of an abridged version of it. But he's doing this, I think, through the election. They think that he's going to somehow have a impact on the election, I think, is the reasoning behind bringing him back to The Daily Show. But this is Fam Boogie. We do this once a week. And the reason why we launched Fam Boogie was to kind of highlight things that are happening in culture and entertainment. I want to get into a little bit later about why we think this show is important and why we started doing it, and kind of its impact on red-pilled America in general. But before we do that, there's some crazy news this week. Of course, Nikki Haley is out.
Thank goodness. Good riddance.
Oh my God, the Wicked Witch is dead. I'm just happy that whole thing is over, and so we can kind of put this warmonger to the side. I'm sure that there are, I was surprised that she even won one state, to be quite honest with you, but she ended up winning, I think, 14 out of 15 states on Super Tuesday, and that was kind of it for her.
She won 14 out of 15?
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Trump won 14 out of 15 states. Yeah, she won one out of 15 states. Thanks for the correction.
And she won D.C., which no one is surprised about.
No. I think that's
the
worst endorsement.
That is D.C.
Yeah, it's the worst endorsement possible. Mm-hmm. But besides that, Adrienne, how was your week? How'd your week go? Why don't you tell the people?
I will tell the people. My week was really good, actually. I was very productive. I'm writing a new story. I'm putting up a lot of content now that I'm a geriatric influencer. My following is growing and growing. I now have 17 followers on Instagram. It's very, very exciting. We went to a movie premiere.
We did.
The Epic Times had the premiere of their movie. It was called
Hollywood Takeover.
Yes. It was interesting.
Yeah, it was, here's us at that event.
And I look exactly like a pilgrim.
That's not true.
I look like a pilgrim and nobody told me. Yeah. Am I a founding father? If you guys are not watching this on video, it's worth it just to see me dressed as a pilgrim for you to sign up. I'm telling you, you're missing out if you haven't seen me as a pilgrim.
There's a lot of style there. Come on.
Yeah, I'm very stylish.
You are.
to myself, in my mind. The movie was interesting. It reminded me a lot about of our episode that we did 3 years ago called Awoken.
Yeah, yeah. It included a lot of the same people, Chris Fenton. And it also had someone from the America First Foundation, I believe, mm-hmm. which we had in ours. And, you know, it's an important topic. And so, you know, you're going to touch on that topic. You're going to speak to some of the, you know, similar players. I think it's an important issue. It's actually premiering March 8th. So if you guys are listening to this afterwards, you can go to Epic Times. And I believe it's Epic TV or Epic Times is where they're streaming
it. I think it's Epic TV.
Yeah. And
it's not Epoch, as I previously thought.
Yeah, I thought it was as well, too. You know, they're doing some documentaries, which is cool. And I think anytime somebody's getting in the game, I think we have to, highlight it whenever we can. And they've been doing some documentaries now for a while. And
good for them.
Good for them. Good for them. And so, the premiere was fun. We got to see Sam Sorbo. We got to meet. Oh, we actually learned. I thought that was kind of interesting. We learned that Charlie Chaplin's granddaughter is a fan of the show. And she was great. It was great meeting her and her husband. She had a really stylish dress on. And, you know, we brought our daughter and we were kind of talking about Charlie Chaplin. She hadn't heard the name. The name didn't ring a bell. And I said, well, look it up. Sure enough, she knew exactly who Charlie Chaplin was. He's the first Hollywood celebrity, first Hollywood famed actor. So the fact that his granddaughter is a fan of the show was kind of a nice little treat to hear.
It was. They were very, very nice.
They were really, really nice. So check that out. It's called Hollywood Takeover. We're actually going to have the Sorbos on. Mm-hmm. Next week, I think it is, or it's within the next 2 weeks, we're going to have Kevin and Sam Sorbo on. So
I'm really looking forward to that.
We're excited.
I really like them. They're a power couple.
We're excited about that.
How was your week?
My week was good. I had this moment, you know, I don't know if this is something that's being spread throughout the United States, but there is an egg shortage going on right now. And so my responsibility is making breakfast in the morning. I enjoy it. It's kind of something that I can take away from my wife, and it's easy for me to do every morning. Well, there was an egg shortage, so we didn't have any eggs, and so I had to figure something out. And so I ended up heading over to Starbucks one day to just make my life easy. And I got us breakfast, and as I was pulling out, there was this woman walking into Starbucks, and at least I thought she was a woman, and I started looking at her. And I wasn't sure because there was a lot of like kind of masculine features. And then as I was kind of pulling out, I just kind of thought, you know what? This kind of sucks the world we're living in right now. I feel bad for like all these women out there that might have like you know, she dressed very feminine. She looked very feminine, but she kind of had masculine kind of features. And I thought, all these women out there with masculine features now that are actually, you know, biologically women are probably getting questioned and what an environment to be in.
So was it a woman or was it a man?
I don't know. I couldn't tell entirely. I thought that she was a woman, and then it started to make me think. And then as I started thinking about it, there's some masculine features there, but it made me feel for women, biological women out there that might have some masculine features, because now they have this whole nother thing, a different thing now that they're having to deal with. So that kind of stood out to me.
I feel like I have masculine energy.
You have perhaps a little bit more aggression than I think that some women have. I think that it's also kind of common amongst maybe some Latinas and some African-American
women.
We run hot. Yeah. And so it makes us men kind of have to be a little bit more, even more kind of strident.
You know, I don't think that it's that I'm aggressive. I think it's that I'm comfortable with confrontation.
Yeah, that's why we call you the Larry David of
I'm okay with confrontation.
Yeah, no, you are. You're comfortable in confrontation without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Yeah, I always do it with a smile.
And I you know, it's definitely made me have to sharpen my sword a little bit more. And
I think you have a very, very sharp sword.
It's sharp. It's definitely
very
sharp.
Very, very
so
sharp.
That was my, I made me feel, I felt for, you know, the feminine, you know, community out there that might have, excuse me, the female community out there that might have some masculine features. So that kind of popped into my head. And I don't know why that was something that stuck out to me this week. And then, you know, we went to the Epic Times.
You know what else we did this week, which was pretty amazing?
What
is we got a new gun? I
yeah,
got a new gun.
We did.
I got the most beautiful gun I have ever laid eyes on. This thing is, she's a beaut.
It's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. I cannot wait to go to the range and use her.
It is gorgeous. We spent a little bit more money on this one because we've bought in the past and we've had issues with like jamming and stuff. And this one, I don't think we're gonna have any problem with that.
It's the official gun of the U.S. Marines.
Exactly.
And it's gorgeous.
Exactly. Ugh. So that was fun. But I want to introduce our guests. But before we get to that, I kind of want to talk a little bit about Fanboogie and why, you know, it's important and why we're doing this. You know, some of our audience members out there might say, you know, be seeing this kind of end up in our Red Pilled America feed a little bit more often than they realized. And they might wondering why we're doing this. And, you know, one of the things that we kind of initially, we launched this show because we saw the power of storytelling and the importance of storytelling. And one of the things that I always kind of thought about was, what would it look like if an alternative Hollywood was created? And one of those things has to do with promotion and promoting creative talent, promoting filmmakers and what have you that are out there. It's an part of the ecosystem needs to be that we have a platform to promote creators. And so that is, you know, one of the main reasons why we decided to jump on to and create Fanboogie. And we're kind of still been, you know, trying to figure out a format that's going to work. You know, I hope you guys can be patient with us and kind of stick with us throughout this process. You know, at times, you know, the other good reason to have this kind of show is that when you're producing long form audio documentaries, sometimes it takes some time to produce these shows. And so we want to be able to put out something new for you guys on a weekly basis. And so that was another kind of reason behind doing this, besides the fact that our faces are made for a video, not for radio.
I think I have a face for radio.
I definitely have a face for video.
I do. You're gorgeous.
I do.
Look at you. You're so chiseled.
Everything about me was made for video.
Yes.
So that was
you're incredible. I am a curmudgeon.
That's not true.
I'm a pilgrim hobbit.
That is not true. So, you know, but really what we saw is this importance that we need to drive home. And, you know, we would talk to actor after actor, filmmaker after filmmaker that put stuff out there. And they're like, you know, we have a hard time finding people to promote our show or our film. We can't get people to cover it. You know, so much of the conservative movement or people on the right or the anti-woke movement is more about politics and covering kind of the day in and day out of politics. And because of that, people that create incredible content don't have an ecosystem that will promote their stuff. And so that is one of the reasons why we thought, you know, Fanboogie is important in that regard, is to create a platform that we can regularly promote other people's stuff. Because, you know, a lot of times we'll have already, you know, produced a show on people, like, for example, Nick Searcy, who we plan to have on this show soon.
Love Nick Searcy.
We love him. You know, like the Robbie Starbuck and his wife, we've had them on the show before as well, too. Well, he has a documentary out. How do we kind of readdress that? Well, we have to create another platform to be able to promote their documentary. So it's things like that. Sam Sorbo, we've had on this show before as well. Now they're involved in this Hollywood takeover. So it's important for us to kind of promote that. How do we do that? We need another platform to do that. And like with Red Pilled America, we kind of see ourselves as kind of helping bring the importance of storytelling back to the anti-woke movement, to the conservative movement. And so we kind of led the way in that in November 2018. And now we're saying, okay, well, that started now. We're seeing people creating this kind of content out there. Now we need to start doing it now we need to see like platforms promoting other people's content. Okay, no one's doing that right now. Let's start the way and get other people's to start doing that as well too. So that is why we created Fanboogie.
You are very generous. Do you know that?
I think we're movement people. We want to fix what's wrong with America. And in order to do that, you know, I want to play this real quickly before we invite our guests on. This was something that I saw going around today. Where is it? It is Joe Biden preparing for his State of the Union. And here he is making a video, speaking to other presidents to prepare for the State of the Union. And who are these other presidents?
So many presidents all at one time. Some of you might know what a big speech like I have to do is coming up State of the Union. Any advice you have for me? Am I delivering my speech?
Well, Sarah.
So for those of you guys just listening to the audio, he's speaking to all of these major Hollywood stars that have played presidents in films and television. And I've said this from for years now. Hollywood is the DNC's West Coast headquarters. And, you know, so many conservatives or anti-woke community wants to either boycott Hollywood or ignore it. But we do that at our own peril. It's important for us to get in the game and to be good at it, because ultimately it is what shifts culture.
Absolutely.
And this is what that documentary touches on. The Hollywood takeover, they touch on this idea that the Chinese government isn't even understanding right now, is that the power of storytelling to shift emotions, to shift culture, to shift opinion and thought. And so often the conservative movement is just kind of wanting to tear it down. And rather than saying, okay, we need to either create our own ecosystem, which we believe is happening right now, and we also need to infiltrate Hollywood and force them to start making content that is pro-American, that is pro-America first, that is pro-free liberty, and pro-our values. So that's why we're doing Fanboogie. And we hope that you guys stick around with us and help us build this new platform. And we're, of course, working on other audio documentaries. We're going to have some over the course of the next couple weeks. That is, of course, our mothership, and that's our where our love is. But at the same time, we want to promote other people's work. It's an important thing to do, and we hope to inspire other platforms like the Daily Wire, like Breitbart, like some of these other very conservative streaming services, Blaze TV, to really, you know, create a segment just focused on this and promoting people that are producing, you know, just good content that doesn't sucker punch you while you're watching it.
And we hope that you guys will support Red Pilled America. So if you guys go to redpilledamerica.com and click join in the top menu, this show could use your support. You guys can help us save America one story at a time. So please come on board. We need you.
We do need you guys. So with that, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to reintroduce you guys to the Nelm Brothers. The Nelms brothers, they were a star of one of our previous episodes, and we'll get right to that after the break.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
More Than a Movie is back with season two of the award-winning film podcast, and this time with a lot more movies. I'm your host, Alex Fumero, and each week I'm going to talk to the people behind some of my favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the OG spy kid, Alexa Penavega.
You had Carla Gugino, who's the coolest mom ever. You had Antonio, who's handsome, amazing, charismatic. And then Carmen and Junie. I felt like a lot of other kids felt like this could be me.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Every episode will feature interviews with the biggest actors, directors, writers, and producers behind your favorite films and tap into the history of Latinos in film. Listen to More Than a Movie as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. On Purpose is dedicated to helping you be happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how he got comfortable with fear, navigating the changes in relationships, and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern. This conversation shows a never-seen-before side to Orlando Bloom and his unique life journey.
I think we all struggle sometimes to really deeply believe that we are enough, that we're valued, that we're valuable. You know, we're imprinted by our parents from the age of 0 to 7, right? Mm. I'm constantly trying to go, like, how do I detach from my this idea of, is that my baggage? It doesn't look like my baggage. I mean, I know, okay, that's mine. Let's unpack that.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to RPA's Fam Boogie. We got another treat for you guys. We have the stars of one of our episodes, Chinwag, from back in the day, and it's become kind of an annual episode for us around Christmas time. And why is that? Because they created one of the, in my opinion, one of the best Christmas movies, at least in the last decade, Fat Man. And they have a new movie out called Red Right Hand. I want to welcome Ian and Esham Nelms. How are you guys doing?
Hey guys, welcome to the show.
Good
afternoon.
We're so happy to have you guys. I got to tell you, the first time I saw Fat Man, I fell in love with it, and I thought these guys are going places. It was one of those kinds of movies that was just different than everything that we'd ever seen. And now I see that you guys have a new movie out called Red Right Hand, and I thought we have to bring these guys back. This is Fam Boogie. We are a new video podcast, but this goes out to our entire Red Pilled America audience. And so I'm pretty sure everybody from our audience knows you, but just to kind of, if anyone hasn't seen Chinwag, Ian, why don't you just tell us a little bit about you guys? Let's start with you. Where are you guys from? And let's start from there.
We're from the Central Valley, California. Lots of dairy farms and ranches up there. But yeah, we grew up there and moved to LA to start making some movies. This is the extremely abbreviated version of our story. I wrestled my way through college over at Cal State Bakersfield. I was an English major, theater minor, but mainly a wrestler. Esh was an artist, a fine artist, and he went to Kansas City Art Institute. And then we have always had a love for movies, but it was this one crazy evening where I was watching two movies really late one night, and I called Esh in the morning. I said, "Man, I really think we should start making movies." And the two movies were Barfly with Faye Dunaway and Mickey Rourke, and The Real Blonde with Matthew Modine and Elizabeth Berkley. And man, that those two movies just really struck both of us. I called Esh in the morning, and he, unbeknownst to me in Kansas City, had been watching the same two movies, which was crazy. We both had a very similar paradigm shift. There was something about those two movies that we could finally see how the sort of, how it was being made. You could see that there was a small amount of characters, there was a small amount of locations, and you could see it a little bit. You could see the sausage being made a little bit. It wasn't like Indiana Jones where you're just like, I'm just immersed in the world and I can't see what's happening. You kind of step back for a second and get a purview of like how it was being done, and you know, naively think, oh, maybe we could do this. So we decided to move down to LA in the early 2000s, 2002, I believe we moved down there. And we've just been cracking ever since, just been grinding away, trying to break into the industry. Made a bunch of, you know, we made two really no budget movies. And then in 2011, we made Lost on Purpose, our first movie with a budget. And then Waffle Street, Small Town Crime, Fat Man, and here we are with Red Right Hand.
And Esham, if I remember correctly, you guys, one of your big breaks was getting rear-ended or something? You guys got in a car accident, right?
I did, yeah. My old Volkswagen Vanagon was rear-ended in a traffic accident in L.A. And fortunately, I'm mechanically inclined, so we took the money. And I fixed the car myself, and we took the money and we bought the DVX 100 camcorder, which had just come out at the time. And that enabled us to start shooting, you know, renegade independent movies all up and down the streets of Los Angeles with our friends.
And this is not like, you know, it's the fascinating thing I think about all this is that it this isn't like an overnight thing. I mean, you guys have been plugging away for, I mean, over 20 years. Am I right on that?
They all lied to us. It's not an overnight success story. Absolutely not. But I think, you know, the marathon makes it that much sweeter.
Yeah, tell me about it. I mean, I think that is it. It's just that learning curve of just kind of plugging away and you rise from the bottom to the top. I just think it's the best way to go. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Red Right Hand and how that came about. And it had a little bit of a different feel for me than Small Town Crime and Fat Man, in that it wasn't. Both of those kinds of have a, and if you guys haven't seen either one of these movies, check them out. Small Town Crime, I love that movie. It has a guy named John Hawkes in it, who I think is just one of those unsung stars. He's recently on True Detective on HBO. I thought he was like the best part of that series. He killed it, and he was great. Small Town Crime, I love that movie. It made me laugh. We were watching it again last night. Mm-hmm. And my wife laughed out loud at a couple of different parts, and that's not her way. But anyways, check these movies out. They are, you know, it's kind of a mixture of action and comedy and mystery. It's a genre that these guys have kind of created all of their own. But to get to Red Right Hand, how did that movie come about?
Well, first of all, Patrick, thank you so much. thank you, Patrick, so much, man. It warms our heart. You know, these movies are such a tremendous undertaking. You know, every one of them is a 2-year story at least. You know, like I said, we took 14 years to get Fat Man made, you know, and then once you even get into the production, then it's a 2-year, you know, 2-year journey to get it to the screen. So yeah, none of these are made overnight. So it warms our heart when someone enjoys them or gets a chuckle out of them, because you know, that's what you do it for.
But tell me how it got started. This Red Right Hand.
Yeah, so we had been trying to find a project with Thunder Road, who do John Wick and Sicario, and they passed us this script. We really enjoyed the characters and the story. Jonathan Easley, the writer, had done a great job. He's from that area. He spent a lot of time in that area, so he knew it really well. The dialogue was pretty spot on. We felt a little a little more grounded. And a little more real, and the characters were really like there was this family dynamic that kicked off the whole thing that really was engrossing. That really drew us to the story. I think for us when we were reading it, we really cared about this family. Being from a rural area ourselves, you know, we grew up on a 10-acre horse ranch. These people are you know, in Kentucky, but they are ranchers. They're trying to make it. It's a struggle, and that ranch life is not an easy life. You know, it just having known people who are ranchers, it is a brutal life. You're constantly, you know, you're constantly chasing your tail, trying to make just ends meet, not a profit most of the time, just trying to survive. So that story really spoke to us, the family plight, and then adding on top of it, Cash's sort of nefarious background and his attempt to redeem himself, and then being drawn back into that world and really being forced into a corner where he didn't really have much choice but to act out and exact, a revenge or crumble or break or give up. You know, there was really only one choice that he had, that he could make there. And that story, we're also big fans of, 70s genre films like, Rolling Thunder and sort of a revenge-o-matic or exploitation revenge flicks of the 70s. And we felt like Jonathan had written a good one, and we really just thought it was awesome and we're excited to do it.
It feels like you guys have been plucked out of the 70s mm-hmm. and just dropped into modern times. I really feel like that. Like when I watch your guys' stuff, it just stands out different than everything else. And just, as far as the synopsis goes for Red Right Hand, it's a uncle and a niece's father is it Kentucky, correct?
Yeah.
They're working a farmland, and there's some nefarious characters within this town, and we learn that Orlando Bloom, who is Cat, plays Cash, had some kind of connection with this nefarious characters, and they basically get in a, he gets kind of pulled back in, like, what's his name from Godfather 3, Michael Corleone. He kind of gets pulled back in to this life, and he's trying to get his family out of that. And so we kind of watched that play out. And it was, I got to tell you, before we were recording, I said that one of the guys I didn't like, and that's because he gave me a bad dream last night. Because I had a dream that I was given kind of a similar kind of Sophie's Choice kind of moment in my dream last night, where I either had to go away with these guys or they were going to take my daughter and wife and kill them. And I attribute you guys for that. So thanks for that nightmare, guys.
We're here for you, Patrick. We're here for you.
Orlando Bloom was so good in the movie. What was it like working with him?
I think it's interesting. I don't know if you touched on this, but our journey with Orlando started in 2017, right after we made Small Town Crime. And we sat down with him. He liked the film. We hit it off over a breakfast, and he was like, man, we should really circle back and make something together. And we agreed. And so when Red Right Hand landed on our desk, we said, you know what would be really amazing is to have Orlando play a character like we've never seen him before. So we hit him up. We knew there were some ingredients in there that he liked. Man loves himself a dirt bike. So we're like, hey, there's some times he gets to be riding up and down the dirt bike. We really just want to see you metamorphosize into this, Southern gentleman. And he was all down. He was super excited. And honestly, he arrived. He started prepping instantly, getting the hair right, getting the facial hair right. Obviously, he morphed his body in a dramatic way. He felt that Cash would be very, very capable. So he did. Started hitting the gym, getting bulked up a little bit. And
he did. And then he got bulked up there. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. He's in great shape.
He's an absolute savage. It's my girlfriend's favorite part of the movie. She just watches it on loop.
Mine too.
But no. No, but he honestly, and then he attacked the dialect with the same tenacity, right? He was out there working for months with the dialect coach. He was recording local people, how they spoke. He was interacting with them. And so, for us, it was amazing because that's exactly what you want, right? You want an actor that's utterly and completely committed to the role, that's going above and beyond and bringing countless nuances to the character.
Yeah, and when I'm talking to my wife, I always run this through. I'm like, is this guy good looking? Is this guy good looking? Like whoever it is around the screen, I'm trying to compare myself to him, And she kind of paused for a second, and then he starts doing these pull-ups. And she goes, yeah, he's good looking.
He's very good looking.
Son of a bitch. he killed it. I thought he was really, really good. Now, I got to tell you that this is one of the things that I noticed about this film and a lot of your films. There's a lot of guns, right? How do you guys deal with that on the set? I know there was this kind of a big controversy that ended in a tragedy on that Rust movie. And when I first saw that story break, I was kind of like, I saw a lot of people kind of blaming Alec Baldwin. And I thought that was unfair, but I also, I don't understand the process and understand like what it's like to have guns on set and what you can and can't do and who's responsible for what. Ian, can you explain a little bit about that, about having guns on set and how, what you guys need to do to kind of prepare for that?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, we're big fans of practical effects, which, you know, obviously they've been doing since the beginning of movies. But there definitely is a protocol set up where, you know, in our case, you know, it's been four or five people check the gun before it's given to the actor. So yeah, there's definitely a protocol in place, and if you follow those, that protocol, it's you should be there. You know, there's four or five fail safes sitting in front of you before the actor gets it and waves it around. I mean, look, we've also been really fortunate in the actors that we've had in those roles have been really familiar with guns as well. And I just remember, you know, working with Mel and Fat Man, like he would always check it as well himself. So even though you'd have three or four or five layers of people checking it, because it goes first, it's like you've got your armor, and then you've got your assistant director. Those are like the first two chains of command. But a lot of times, your key grip, who is in charge of safety on set, comes over and checks it as well. And a lot of times, your either props person, who sometimes doubles as the backup to the armor if they have training. The props person, who also is in charge of props / guns / you know, likes to check it as well just to be sure. So obviously, right there, you've got on a very basic level, on a very 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 rudimentary set, you've got four levels right there. Immediately, they're going to get their hands and eyes on that gun before the actor does. So yeah, and that's a very bare bones, you know, system right there. I think if you follow, I get the scare, because it's always scary for us too. But yeah, I think if you follow the protocol, I mean, the other thing we did is anytime we were close to the camera, you would have a shield in front of a shield in front of the camera and the camera operators, even if, you know, they're not aiming at the camera, but even though it's close, you want to make sure that you have something for any kind of projectile, like a, you know, anything could pop off of that gun or out of that ammo, especially since it's a blank and it's built differently. And, you know, the shells are still popping out, so you could get hit by a shell or even a little piece of the blank. So they always, if you're in a certain proximity, we've always had like a shield up in front of the camera. Now, is that going to stop a bullet? Probably not. But it's going to stop anything else, and it could give the bullet trouble hitting a straight mark. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, Ian and I have used thousands and thousands of rounds on the last three movies. I mean, thousands of rounds. We follow the protocols diligently. Safety is our number one deal. This is a very, very robust system, and if followed correctly, it's virtually foolproof.
But yeah, yeah. It seems like it would be. I mean, it's been. I mean, there's guns in movies are just something that is so common nowadays. It seems like. I mean, obviously, not even just nowadays. I mean, it feels like the movie business was built on it. And so, when that accident happened, it was just kind of like a shocking thing. And I just had to hear like the process behind it, because I've never been on set with, you know, firearms. And I just thought this is definitely something that would keep me up at night after that accident happened. Something came up. Have you guys seen the recent Dune 2 movie?
I haven't seen
Dune 2 yet.
No. Okay. There's this, I wanted to get your guys' take on this, cuz the director, I think Denis Villeneuve, had a comment, and I wanted to run this by you guys and tell me what your guys' take was on this as filmmakers. He said, "Frankly, I hate dialogue. Dialogue is for theater and television. I don't remember movies because of a good line. I remember movies because of a strong image. I'm not interested in dialogue at all. Pure image and sound, that is the power of the cinema, but it is something not obvious when you watch movies today." When I heard that, I was kind of like, that doesn't resonate with me. Like, what was that movie that we just saw during Christmas with Paul Giamatti? Adriana,
The Holdovers.
Holdovers, thank you. I love that movie. I think Paul Giamatti is incredible. I thought the dialogue, I mean, it's all dialogue. It's all character. Then I went and saw Dune 2, and I'm like, oh, I kind of see what he's saying in that the imagery of Dune, I mean, it's kind of along the lines of Dune, but Dune 2, it just takes it up another notch. Like the visual imagery is just incredible.
It's epic.
It's epic. And I left there just kind of like in awe of what he was able to do. But you guys, it seems like there's a nice kind of mix with you guys. I mean, you guys go for the visual stuff. I noticed that. But then you guys also have like some great like one-line quips. And I just want to get both of you guys, Ian, you first, reaction to how in your method. Is it something that you is dialogue is important, more important to you guys, or is the image more important?
I think that there's definitely a shared experience there. I mean, that's a pretty bold blanket statement Denis made. There's filmmakers that, you know, rely pretty heavily on dialogue, like Tarantino. And I wouldn't want to trade that guy's films for anything. I love Tarantino's films, and they're very dialogue dependent and moment to moment dependent. He's not always looking, you know, he always has great shots, but he's not always worried about the great shots. He's worried about great storytelling, and sometimes that's shots and sometimes that's dialogue. So for him, now Denis may be focusing on the shots, and I love that guy's movies. So it's hard. I wouldn't want to trade any of his movies. I'm a big fan of his films as well. So I think there's just different ways to make the sausage. And if that's what inspires him, and I mean, that's one of the funnest things about art, right? Is that you're watching, you know, a person's personal preference and style and dialogue and, you know, what they think is a great look or a great shot. I mean, and that's no different for us, right? And we're taking inspiration from people we love. So, and it's definitely a mix. You know, Paul Thomas Anderson has some wonderful dialogue in his movies. It may not be as like shocking or, you know, as highly stylized as Tarantino's at times, but he is incredibly nuanced and funny and meaningful, PTA, I'm saying, with his dialogue. So I wouldn't want to trade any of his films. Loves all his films. So yeah, I just feel it's for us, I would say it's mutual. Like, we love great shots. We love great dialogue. We definitely try to have moments for both.
Esham, you feel the same?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, I think, you know, look, your taste is going to be reflected in the art that you make. Ours certainly is. I think I just agree with you, man. I do agree with you that The Holdover is such a tremendous film. Everyone's got to see it.
It is.
But you didn't disagree with him on something?
I do agree with you. Yeah,
oh, okay.
Sorry. My brain is not 100% this morning. I'm a little under the weather. They're getting crossed, and it's not all coming out how I hoped it would.
Yeah, no, I mean, as far as like dialogue goes, I mean, I did take that statement as kind of like a little bit of a shocker. Now, once I saw his movie, I was kind of like understanding where he was coming from, because just visually, it was just, you know, one of those kinds of movies that I think is going to go down in cinema history in that regard. We'll be right back with RPA's Fan Boogie after the break.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
More Than a Movie is back with season 2 of the award-winning film podcast, and this time with a lot more movies. I'm your host, Alex Fumero, and each week I'm going to talk to the people behind some of my favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the OG spy kid, Alexa Penavega.
You had Carla Gugino, who's the coolest mom ever. You had Antonio, who's handsome, amazing, charismatic. And then Carmen and Junie. I felt like a lot of other kids felt like this could be me.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Every episode will feature interviews with the biggest actors, directors, writers, and producers behind your favorite films and tap into the history of Latinos in film. Listen to More Than a Movie as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. On Purpose is dedicated to helping you be happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how he got comfortable with fear, navigating the changes in relationships, and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern. This conversation shows a never-seen-before side to Orlando Bloom and his unique life journey.
I think we all struggle sometimes to really deeply believe that we are enough, that we're valued, that we're valuable. You know, we're imprinted by our parents from the age of 0 to 7, right? Mm. I'm constantly trying to go like, how do I detach from my, from this idea of what, is that my baggage? It doesn't look like my baggage. I mean, I know, okay, that's mine. Let's unpack that.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to RPA's Fam Boogie.
How is AI impacting the business?
Really, really impressive tool. And I will say, you know, part is like, we've been pretty hesitant to use it. You know, we've spent our lifetimes gathering the skills to do the types of things that AI is very accomplished at doing right now. Or I would say accomplished at doing, very accomplished is coming. I think, you know, on the horizon, there is definitely a chance, if left to do what it's going to do, to put a lot of really talented people out of work. So we need to be, you know, we need to be cautious with it. But it is a wonderful tool.
Yeah, I think as long as we're using it in the right way, it can be a massive asset and time saver at times. And I think you can use it. I think the one thing that I'm seeing right now, right, is that, you know, AI is doing a great job of sort of going out and grabbing a bunch of things that exist and sort of mixing them up in a jambalaya and saying, hey, what about this? How about this? It looks like this. Maybe like this. Is that what you're asking for? And I think it'll get so good that you can do it with video, as you start. We started to see a couple of weeks ago. But I do think that you're still going to want some inventive stories that come from creative minds that have a personal touch. And, you know, whether that's an AI creating the images, I'm fine with that, to be honest, you know, as long as it has an artist or an author behind it, I think is what I'm more looking for. I'd be looking more for the voice rather than, I mean, because you're still creating images. I mean, it'd be like, you know, someone doing an animation and you being pissed off because it's not real people. I mean, you're still, AI is technically kind of animating, even though it looks very realistic, images. So that doesn't quite scare me very much. Now, when the AI starts taking on the duties of like, oh, I'm going to tell the whole story, you know, step to the left, human, I've got this. I don't know if it's going to be anything but an amalgam of already told stories and moments, which could be interesting to a point. But I think you're going to get those reference points in a way that you're going to want something a little more original or a little more personal touch. You know what I mean? A little less cookie cutter, a little less by the numbers at times, you know?
Yeah, we've actually worked with it. We did an episode, a full episode it was more than one episode. We did a series of episodes. And I would say that I was not – I went in afraid that AI could take my job at some point, and I left completely unafraid.
Mm-hmm.
It was good at very algorithmic type thinking and very just the way that you would think a computer would work, very formulaic, good at like history kind of storytelling. But a lot of the stuff you'd have to fact check, and it just like, you know, it was kind of off on certain things. And I did leave like thinking, you know what, the nuances of writing a story and just that human touch. And there's this like quick, there's just one line that just kind of touches on things. And there's just, it wasn't entirely there. Will it get there? Perhaps. you know, but I wasn't afraid when I was done with that series, and it made me feel like, okay, it's a good tool. It's like Google, or, you know, searching for Google, or, you know, I think the main thing that if I was an illustrator, I would be concerned in regards to some of the stuff that from a graphic design standpoint that it can do. But
yeah.
it doesn't seem like it also, even in that sense, if you need a little tweak, or maybe you want the jacket to be a different color, or you want his arm raised a little bit, like, it's just not good with that stuff. And so when it's still like the human is still, I think, an important part of the equation. I'm sorry to cut you off there, Esham. I don't know if you had something to add to that.
No, I think you're absolutely right. You just nailed it, right? But I would say that's interesting, right? It's been like many of the greats, you know, dream, right, to have the black box that they can just speak into in their pictures or beget upon the screen. You know, with Sora and all this stuff coming right now, you can almost see that happening, right? It's pretty wild, you know, in 10 years that you'll be dictating a movie into or writing it into, you know, just downloading your script. It'll present a version, you'll revise it. It's really intriguing to see where this is going to extrapolate down the road.
It is. Some of those videos that came out were pretty shocking. I want to ask you guys this as well too. In, you know, back before there was the internet and social media, movies were kind of like the cultural, movies and music were like the cultural impact institutions, you know, of America. When social media came, and then now you got streaming. I had a conversation with David Goyer, screenwriter. I think his Foundation was kind of his most recent kind of a big deal. And I remember talking to him about, because he was kind of known for films and kind of sticking in the films direction. He was like, you know what? Television is I'm seeing where streaming is going. I'm seeing the television is kind of like the place for storytelling. My question is do you guys, does films have the same impact culturally, do you think, than that it did, say, 20 years ago? Ian?
Maybe not all films, right? But I definitely think there are films that have cultural impact. Maybe television has taken the mantle a little bit, but I think it shifts back and forth a lot. I think a lot of times people get worried about one, you know, outpacing the other and leaving the other behind. But I feel like, a lot of these places, like, there's a lot of times I don't want to sit down and watch a series. There's a lot of times I want to sit down and watch something that's going to have a beginning and an ending and be able to move on with my day, my life. You know, I am reluctant, personally, I'm reluctant to sit down and watch a lot of series. I got three kids, you know, they do a lot of activities. I do a lot of activities. I also got to get some work done. My wife and I have to spend some time together. So, and when we do sit down to watch something, we're very reluctant to get into a new series unless it's something where someone's like, hey, you need to watch this for this reference or whatever, and it's a business type of thing. I'll watch one or two of them and try to move on. Mainly because I just don't want to sit there for 30 hours.
Yeah. The commitment associated with it is big.
Yeah.
Esham, what are your thoughts on that in regards to film's impact today as compared to, you know, 20 years ago or so?
I think you have a very similar echo happening with the movie business that happened with music. It's the nature of technology, right? As soon as you take that reverence of going down to the record store and flipping through the albums or the CDs, and you find that cherished record and you listen to it for a week and you memorize every lyric, and you really get attached and invested with that music and that artist. It gives you time, right? And the way we consume stuff now, there's a real lack of reverence for a lot of it, right? You flip on your streamer, there's, you know, thousands of options to watch. You don't have to go anywhere. It's super convenient. You can walk to the kitchen. You know, it's treated very casually, right? The cinematic experience from the past was you go to the blackened movie house with the community, you watch the movie, you're totally immersed. It's, you know, 30 feet tall. And that's a very magical experience. And that's not how a lot of people are experiencing movies these days, right? So you can see a sort of correlation with the lack of reverence that would occur.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Like, we went and saw the Dune movie in IMAX, and it's just like, I want to see films on the big screen. Like, it's the place to see it. I mean, I like the TV, and it's convenient sometimes, but the big screen is where it's at. I hope I'm hoping that this kind of, you know, post COVID, people start and not just the big stuff. Like, I don't want to just see, you know, Planet of the Apes and Dune on the big screen. I'd like to see like a good, you know, character driven thing on the big screen as well, too. But it seems like that's kind of where a lot of the push is the big screen kind of push seems to be these kind of big tentpole type of films.
TV was spending so much money to outpace cinema, right? With the streamers and like Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones. And mm-hmm. you know, even when Sopranos came in, right, had a huge budget to get that cinematic quality on the screen. I think now they've kind of realized, oh, wow, that's a really, that's not a viable model, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're not getting the viewership that warrants from spending this kind of money on these series. So now it's going to shift back to the big screen. You also get these moments, these ebbs and flows where the studios sort of safety up and they sort of go with convention. And then all of a sudden they start getting outpaced. I mean, TV was like the most inventive medium for the last 10 years. It was letting artists just go buck out there and have a great, great time and really delivering powerful new shows. And now they're kind of letting that happen with cinema. I mean, what version of Barbie did we ever see coming like this, right? That's such an outside the box version of Barbie. And that's why it had the cultural resonance that it did, right? You're going to let someone like Nolan go buck with Oppenheimer. Like, people are going to show up. They want to see that splendor, right? Give me a 3.5 hour, uber expensive, you know, grandiose spectacle to go watch. I'll do it. Now, you cut the same reins loose on these independent cinemas and have some of these smaller films come out, you're going to start getting Pulp Fictions again. You're going to start getting exciting movies that drive people to the theaters, right? But there is there's a restraint and a hesitation with a lot of studios that to let people go out and really make bold pieces.
Seems like it. It seems like it. I don't know what that is, what's that driving factor, but it seems to be the case. I was one thing that I was really kind of taken by your red right hand was the I love the fact that the Christians weren't pushovers, like, or at least the pastor wasn't a pushover. You know, it's so often you see movies where it might have like some kind of religious overtones and they're kind of like, you know, the doormats. And in this case, you know, it wasn't the case. I don't want to give away any spoilers or anything, but there was a bit of a more of a, I guess the term that you guys used was an Old Testament, you know, vibe to it. Was that intentional?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Wilder played by Garrett Dillahunt, and he knew that man inside and out, right? This is a man who's come from the life, rehabilitated himself through the word of the Lord and his congregation. And, you know, you push him, he's going to shove back. So he's not going to sit there and just take it. Obviously, there's a lot of trepidation and a lot of consideration, and that's the foibles of man, right? You're battling your religion and your beliefs and what you might have to do. And that's a lot of the appeal that the story had to us.
Yeah, we really liked that part of the script. You know, Jonathan had that in there. You know, we had a fun time shooting those scenes. And I think the actors had a fun time playing those characters who, you know, at times I had to really dig deep and find, you know, you read that Old Testament and there are certainly some pretty rough moments in there.
Yes, there are.
I think you know, us seeing that and seeing these characters have to fight their way out of something. I mean, I think a lot of times in current times, you know, most people are looking for the most comfortable, easy way out of something and how to live their lives without being uncomfortable. Whereas I think you lose something by being too comfortable. You know, you lose a certain perspective. I don't want to say that you want to be a hardened human, because I don't think you do. I think that actually rough experiences make you a more understanding and empathetic person. Because if you've had those rough experiences, if you've been the person that's been bullied, you're a lot less likely to bully, in my experience, because you have the empathy for the person who's having that tough time. And I think that is sort of represented in this film in a way that these guys have been on that dark side. And when they see that dark side coming for them and, you know, they do everything they can to sort of avert it or to, okay, I'm going to do these three jobs and then hopefully you'll leave my family alone. But when that doesn't do it and you get the wide perspective, you know, he really doesn't have a choice. You know, there's a certain scene in the middle of the film where Big Cat does something that's pretty, you know, a couple of somethings in a row that are pretty irreversible. And we love that part of it because I think it gives, as an audience member, when we were reading it, and I think you feel this in the film when you're watching it, you go, okay, that person needs to be taken out of the equation right now. Like, she does not need to be around any longer. She's, she's done things that are beyond what I think a person should be allowed to do. You know, she's done. And then for us, you know, the fun was to watch, you know, your guy who's been pushed or your guys or your characters who have been pushed, you know, come back and start fighting and find a way to get rid of her.
How do you guys break up your workload? So, you know, we're a married couple and we work together. And for us, I find that if we each have our own tasks, we will fight a little bit less. Do you guys handle different things or do you, you know, wear the same hats sometimes?
We definitely have different skill sets, like what we're stronger at. But I would say, you know, we're not afraid to cross over as well. And we're constantly encouraging each other to cross over and do more of what the other one is supposedly better at. Because there's definitely times, you know, where, and I think that's the complementary, and that's why we like working together so much is that we do complement each other really well in that, like, let's say, you know, Esh does all the storyboarding, but then I'll come up with a few shots that are, you know, that were outside of the box that he wasn't thinking of. And the same thing happens in, you know, other ways throughout the entire film, the editing process, when we're directing, when we're writing, we'll brainstorm an idea. Esh will be like, okay, I'm going to write that down. I'm going to write that scene or whatever. And then I'll come back tomorrow and have it already written, and pass it to him. And he'll be like, I was going to write that. And I'm like, well, you should have been a lot quicker. and he'll go through it and put down so many things that I didn't think of. I didn't think we're going to be in that scene. Or he'll read something that I did and be like, oh, you know what? I saw it this way. And he'll change it this other way that I didn't even think of. And then when I read it, I really like, you know, a lot of, if not all, the changes that he put in there. And it just enhanced it. So, and then the same thing will happen. He'll put a scene down and he'll pass it to me and I'll take a pass at it. And he'll be like, oh, I didn't think of that. You know, it's just, it's really fun. It's really fun to do because it's just, you know, we used to play these epic G.I. Joe wars when we were like 10 and 11, in the living room, and they would take 3 or 4 days sometimes to complete. And it would just be, you know, hundreds of G.I. Joes and vehicles set up against each other. And we would have little scenarios built out for every one of the person's deaths or heroic moments. And it would just take that long to play out. So our parents would be stepping over these things for 3 or 4 days as they occupied the living room because they'd be on the couch and we'd use everything, the piano, as they were all like, you know, had this battleground. It feels like that on a different level. It just feels like we're still kind of playing G.I. Joes and storytelling. It's fun.
I love that.
Me and Adriana, I think our biggest fight on the show was overdoing this episode on this one guy. And she was like, I don't like this guy. I don't trust him. We must have fought for like 3 or 4 months straight.
I don't know if it was that long.
Like every time I tried to bring it back, she was like, no, no, no. And I tried to bring it back for 3 or 4 months. Finally, I broke her down and got her to do it. We did the episode and you could hear it. People that listen to our show, they'll know which episode we're talking about. And you could hear it in her voice. She's like, she's reading the script. And you could tell she's just not feeling anything that she's doing. Turns out a year later, we find out the guy was totally lying to us about his story. And we had to do a mea culpa basically and do a whole nother episode.
Wow.
It basically exposed the lies. And it was kind of like, you know, I learned from that point on, you know, you have to trust your partner. I think I have already learned that lesson, but it was something that I had to relearn. You know, trust your partner, you know, trust their instincts. Don't force the issue when it comes. I'm sure you guys have had similar kind of, you know, trusting your partner kind of things where you had maybe an awakening moment. Has that ever happened, Esham, before?
Constantly. Constantly. I think I think that the thing that I'm truly blessed to go to work every day with my brother, to be honest, because I mean, there's nobody, look, other than my girlfriend, you know, it's a dead even heat between who I want to hang out with on the daily, right? I mean, he and I have just gotten along so well since we were kids. And that's been really part of the joy of this collaboration, is that we get to go to work and play pretend all day. It's insane. But yeah, no, there's definitely times where I'll come in and I'm not 100%, right? I'm dragging Fanny a little bit, and Ian's right there to give me a kick in the keister to get going, you know, or I'm a little, I mean, you know, it's a hard business, and sometimes your spirits are down and we're there to pick each other up. So that sort of handoff happens constantly. And we do get into creative tussles, right? Rarely physical. Ever since Ian became a very accomplished wrestler, it's all about talking it out. You know, no more physical violence that way. But no, it's like, but passion wins, right? And it'll be like, he'll write something down, or I'll write something down, and they'll be like, hey, you know, da, da, da. And he's like, oh, that line stinks. And I'm like, well, if it was said like this, you know, and then we'll flamboyantly act it out, and he'll be like, okay, well, maybe if it was like that, you know, like there's just like yin and yang, and it's the passion wins. And there's times where Ian's like put his foot down and like, no, this moment needs to be in the movie. And I'm like, well, then let's put it in the movie. And there you go. People in the theater are like giving it a standing ovation. So it's like, yeah, I guess you were right.
That's a great way to look at it. The passion wins line, I think, is a really good way to look at it. It's exactly right.
Yeah, we've had so many moments like that in the films we've made where there's literally been a line that Ash will come up with that he puts in there that he's dead set needs to be in there. And I'm like, it just doesn't feel like the character. It just doesn't feel like he's like, I think it feels like the character perfectly because of this and this and this. And I'm like, well, I'm just on the fence. And he's like, well, I'm extremely passionate about it. And then it'll stay in the movie. And I'll be damned if that isn't like the biggest laugh, you know, that pops out on the screen at a time. And I'm just like, you bastard, you were right. You were right.
It goes both ways, honestly, all the time, constantly. Like, we get to the end of these screenplays, and like, we can't even remember who wrote what. If we write them, right? We're like, did you write that or did I write that? I don't know. We both wrote it. It's just all like hodgepodge at this point.
I have to ask you guys, what was it like working with Mel Gibson? I you know, the guy's a legend. I thought it was interesting because the time that you guys worked with him, I mean, I know the guy tends to have controversy occasionally, right? And I don't know if that came into play for you guys, where you guys ever had to, like, was there ever any issue in regards to any controversy that had kind of swirled around him at one point or not? What was it like working with him? And was there any kind of resistance to working with him given the past controversies that he's been in?
I mean, the first thing we did when we thought of him for the role and it actually became a reality, is we started asking around to anybody and everybody we knew that had any tie to the man. And every one of them said, you want to work with this guy. You want to work with this guy. He's a great person. You want to work with this guy. And we were like, okay. And so when we sat down with him, they were like, hey, you got 45 minutes. You know, 4 hours later, we emerged from that meeting, you know, having talked up and down and around about the film and about life and about past, present, future. And we felt like we had a really good feel for the guy. And he couldn't have delivered better on the set. He was a consummate professional. You know, we tell this tale, because it really was sort of it basically personifies the entire shoot. We had 4 days in the last shootout to shoot in the cold, and it was -32 degrees outside. -32. It was unbelievably cold. We had 4 days to shoot out in that, and he stayed out there the entire time. Never went into a warming tent, we finished him for the first hour or two, and we said, okay, Mel, you can go to a warming tent on the first day of it. And he's like, okay, thanks. And then 20 minutes later, like, Walton Goggins comes in to shoot something on his side, and we shoot for a while, and then we turn around and we see Mel, and we're like, oh my God, did he not hear us? Like, what? This is horrible. He's going to be so pissed off because he could have been in a warming tent for the last 30 minutes, and he's sitting out here in -32 degrees freezing his buns off. And we go up to him and we're very apologetic. We're like, Mel, I'm so sorry. Like, did you hear us 20 minutes? You know, we said you were cut. Sorry, we're not going to see you for another hour or so. So, no, no, I heard you. I heard you. It's just, if you're going to be out in this crap and you're going to have the crew out in this crap and you're going to have
other actors out in this, then I'm not going anywhere. So this is how I run my sets. Like, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be out here with you. If you're out here, I'm out here. And he was like that the whole shoot. Just, you know, in it with you the whole time. And there was a big sense of camaraderie because he was out there with us the whole time, talking to grips, telling stories about Braveheart and Hacksaw Ridge, and just awing everybody with, you know, with his graciousness and his kindness. Yeah, and laughing and having a great time, even though we knew he was freezing his cojones off out there.
That would be intimidating. Wow. That would be so intimidating. Like, I can imagine, like, doing, like, an audio documentary series on I don't know, let's say, who's an incredible producer, Quincy Jones, and having him be there as I'm producing this thing, that had to be kind of, you know, because the guy is, how many movies has the man done? How many incredibly iconic, you know, life-changing, you know, immortal films has that guy made? And you guys are on set and you guys are making the decisions on certain things. Like, Esham, is that one of the things that that come in your mind at all when you were filming Fat Man and you're, you know, standing with this guy and you're making decisions and he, this guy is like an icon standing next to you?
I mean, in the beginning, definitely, right? You're like, oh, wow, how do you direct Mel Gibson, the man's, you know, won Academy Awards? So that definitely crosses your mind, but I will say he did such a great job of putting us at ease, you know, right away. I do know there was like this moment though where we were like on day 4 or 5 of shooting, and we had to actually start with that the climactic set piece at the end first, just because of the way the weather lined up. And he came to us and he goes, "Hey guys, you know, you think I could see something?" It was like we were shooting through the week. "Do you think I could see something this weekend? Like, pop by my." My apartment and show me something that you guys have, some of the footage." I'm like, "Oh yeah, cool, no problem." And we're like, okay, so Ian and I feverishly edit rough together, like some of the shootout with the assistant editor there. And we come over and obviously, you know, you're sitting there with bated breath, you're nervous because this is your lead and man's made a lot and done a lot. And obviously we're big fans. So we come over and honestly, like we put it on and he instantly starts laughing and chortling and having a ball with the footage. And I think honestly, from that moment on, he didn't ask us to see a single frame after that until we were done. And we just had a blast making the movie. Right. I mean, it was just like, he was like, "Great, this is gonna be great. I can't wait to see it." You know, and that was
total
the end of
classic.
It.
It's a classic, man. If you guys have not seen Fat Man, you guys got to go out and see Fat Man. We're going to leave you guys with one question that we kind of, that we've been asking people. And I want to know, how do you guys want to be remembered? I know you guys have been in this film business for a while now. You guys are still making moves. I know we're going to end up seeing, you know, more incredible films come out of you guys. But in regards to legacy, have you guys thought about that? Like, how do you guys want to be remembered? Ian, Esham, go ahead. Take a stab at it, Esham.
No, I don't know. Honestly, that's such a hard question. I think like your priorities shift over time, right? I mean, in the beginning, you're just trying to get on the board. And then, you know, Ian and I are masochists. So we're setting the goal higher and higher and higher, right? We're moving that goal line. I was leaning into
what you were saying, Ash. And I'm just looking at some of the projects we're currently working on. And I would say that we haven't, like, look, there's, the stuff that we write and direct that is like our babies, that are our babies, like, of course, we're like extremely attached to those because they came from, you know, our imagination and our from start to finish, you know, and they feel very much ours, fully ours, us. They feel like us, not just ours, but us. So those, we're extremely proud of every film we've ever made. So it's hard to like try to start picking babies and pulling limbs off and saying we like this one better than this one. But you definitely feel a lot of kinship to the ones that you've shepherded through the entire process of writing, coming up with the idea all the way to releasing it. But like Jonathan's film, The Red Right Hand, it was personal to us because not only did we feel those characters, but it's a genre we wanted to play in, you know, that 70s revenge-o-matic. Like, it's something that we like, and it was fun for us to make because it was such a wild, it was coupled with it was a Revenge-O-Matic, and able to put Orlando and Andy and Garrett in those roles and watching them play in that sandbox was incredibly fun. It's just a movie you would not expect to see those actors doing. And they did such great work in it, fully committing to those characters. It was so much fun. We had such a blast. But I would say we haven't made the film yet that I would say is going to like personify us. And I would say the films, there's stuff up ahead of us, that we're looking at. And yeah, I want to be remembered for the films that we've made for sure. But I also want to be remembered for the films that we're going to make, because I'm really excited about them. So I don't think we're quite there yet. I feel, you know, we got another 20 films in us. And I'm very excited to see where we go, because we have pretty lofty goals. You know what I mean? And it's not like, hey, you know, let's get the budgets up. It's more like, hey, some of the ideas and the scripts that we've been working on are pretty freaking wild. So we're really excited to get into that wild territory. And that's what you do, right? You have to sort of build up that trust to get those wilder films. And that's what we've been working on.
I will say this, if it's a three act structure, I feel like we're still in act one.
Exactly.
Makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense. Well, guys, thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. You know, we're huge fans of your work. Everybody got to go check out Red Right Hand. If you're into, like, let's say Death Wish or something along those lines, it's that kind of revenge flick that was a classic in the 70s. These guys have put their touch on that kind of genre, and I can't say enough about these guys. They make incredible films. Thank you so much for being here with us, guys. And please keep us abreast of what you guys do in the future. And we'd love to get behind whatever you guys are doing. We really appreciate it.
Patrick, Adriano, we can't thank you enough for having us on. We love chatting with you. So much appreciated,
guys.
Thanks, guys.
Let's do it again.
Definitely. We'll be right back with RPA's Fan Boogie after the break.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.
More Than a Movie is back with season two of the award-winning film podcast, and this time with a lot more movies. I'm your host, Alex Fumero, and each week I'm going to talk to the people behind some of my favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the OG spy kid, Alexa Penavega.
You had Carlo Gugino, who's the coolest mom ever. You had Antonio, who's handsome, amazing, charismatic. And then Carmen and Juni. I felt like a lot of other kids felt like this could be me.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Every episode will feature interviews with the biggest actors, directors, writers, and producers behind your favorite films and tap into the history of Latinos in film. Listen to More Than a Movie as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. On Purpose is dedicated to helping you be happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how he got comfortable with fear, navigating the changes in relationships, and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern. This conversation shows a never-seen-before side to Orlando Bloom and his unique life journey.
I think we all struggle sometimes to really deeply believe that we are enough, that we're valued, that we're valuable. You know, we're imprinted by our parents from the age of 0 to 7, right? Mm. I'm constantly trying to go, like, how do I detach from this idea of, is that my baggage? It doesn't look like my baggage. I mean, I know, okay, that's mine. Let's unpack that.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to RPA's Fan Boogie. Well, that was fun.
That was really, really fun. I have to say that what I will remember them for is the brotherhood and the fact that they are family. I love that. I love the amount of respect and clearly the amount of love that they have for one another. You know, when they say things like, working with my brother every day is a pleasure. Their parents must be so, so proud. And I love that this idea of promoting and advocating for working with your family, because there's nothing better. I love going to work every single day and working with my husband. It's a dream come true, truly. You know, we went to an event this week and we brought our daughter with us. It's a family affair all the time. And I love that the Nelms brothers are their brothers and they love working with one another.
You know, it's a gift. It is a gift to work with family. And when you have the ability to do that, I mean, we are huge proponents of that. And I think on top of that, I think that you end the content and the creative that end up coming out of it, if you are in the creative realm, ends up being that much better. I mean, these guys are master storytellers. They're a master filmmakers. And I strongly suggest that you guys check out their movies. Check out Fat Man. Check out Small Town Crime. I'm telling you,
that one is so good.
It was so good.
So good.
It was so good. There's a little bit of a hint of humor in it. If you're into Death Wish 2, you got to check out.
That's an old school reference right there.
If you're into those kinds of revenge flicks, it is. Check out their new flick, Red Right Hand. So let's do what we love to do on this show. Let's do a little bit of film reviews next. So I want to, kind of rapid fire these because we've been seeing a lot lately.
We had a busy week.
We did have a busy week. So I would love to get your vibes, Adriana. Let's get this list going here.
All righty.
We're going to talk about Anyone But You. This has actually been in the theaters for a while now. It's streaming. And I think it's been kind of making the rounds a lot lately because what's her name? The Sweeney. What's her first name?
Sydney. Sydney Sweeney. She was in Euphoria. She was also in White Lotus. And she is a hot little ticket right now.
She is. Her and Glenn Powell star in Anyone But You. It's a rom-com.
Yeah. This did very well at the box office.
It killed it at the box office. I think because of that, we're going to be seeing them work together a lot more. I will say this. I didn't love the film. I thought that it introduced kind of an LGBTQ storyline. I mean, the entire theme of the show has an LGBTQ storyline. It's basically one of the characters is a woman. She's marrying another woman, and so that's weaved throughout the entire film. I thought that kind of took me out of it a little bit, just because the overall tenor. I think that if you'll see this, and once again, I've seen plenty of gay characters in films before where it doesn't take me out of character. It doesn't take me out of the film. But this one in particular, it just did. It just didn't make sense.
You know, they were trying very hard. I felt like the whole movie was lackluster. And I did not feel the chemistry between the two leads.
No.
Which is interesting because they're both super hot. They're both super good looking. I mean, she's cutesy, but, you know, she's hot. She's a hot chick. She's got a super hot body. But there was no chemistry between them.
No. And she, you know, I think that some of the directions she's going to be going with her career, I've been seeing some of the films that she has coming up is going to frustrating me. So
what are you going to give it?
I'm going to give it a no way. I'm giving it a no way. It's pretty easy for me. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't think it was something that was worth my time. And
that's a great way to put
yours.
It.
Yours? Yeah.
I'm giving it a no way. I felt like it was a big fat waste of time. I would have preferred to be reading Scott Adams' new book. Really, I'm enjoying the book. It's a good book, and I would rather have been doing that.
I agree with you on that one. So next, we're going to talk about True Detective. We spoke about this episode, the series, before. It's on HBO. It stars Jodie Foster, of course, and there's a boxer. Her name is, I'm going to get this wrong, Callie Rise, I think is her name. Mm. And she is the series. Listen, I was a huge true detective fan for many years.
You know, they've had a couple of seasons, really good
incredible
ones.
Seasons. In particular, with what's his name, McAuliffe, or what's his name from?
What if you could ever remember a name? What would that be like?
With names.
He is so bad with names. It's weird because you have such a high intellect.
I'm going to say the first two seasons were great, and I can't remember.
I think so too. And you know what? One of our friends was also on True Detective, and he did a good job. So, you know, this series was a feminist wet dream. It truly was.
It was the most anti-male
series
I've ever seen.
The ending episode was so disappointing. Episode 5, there was a really good scene in it. That kind of kept us in.
It did. John Hawks, who's also in Small Town Crime by the Nelms Brothers.
He was good.
He was good. I think he was the kind of shining light in this film. I don't want to do any spoilers if you're watching this, but I thought that there was a moment that he really almost brought us back into this film.
You know what? I thought all the acting was good, if I'm being honest. I thought it was
well
acted. Yeah,
the acting was solid. The acting
there was
solid.
A problem with the story and the writing.
It was just the I don't know how
else
to put
anti-male.
It was anti-male.
Yeah, I don't like that.
It was anti-male. So because of that, it just at the very end, I felt like I was tricked. I got sucker punched at the very end. When you commit so much time to a film, and then all of a sudden they sucker punch you. You're watching six, episodes. You're taking up like close to 6 hours of your time, of your life that I can't get back now. I'm giving it a note. It's an easy note for me. You, Adriana?
I'm giving it a no way. Is it a note or
you're right?
Wait,
no way.
You're confusing me.
I'm sorry.
My gosh.
We used to use note, and then people said, "Oh, that sounds too much like ote."
Liz said, "Go with the no way." Right?
No way. It was no way. So it's no way for both.
It's a no way for both Cortez and Carelci. We're going to poo poo this one.
We're going to poo poo this one. Okay.
All right,
so
let's go to Dune 2.
We've been having a lot of no ways lately.
Oh my god!
Let's move on to Dune Part 2. I'm going to say right off the bat that we were pretty big Dune fans, and we have seen the first Dune. I want to say I've seen it probably 5 or 6 times.
That's too many times.
I'm just like that. When I see a movie that I really like, I want to understand it and break it apart and understand why I'm liking it.
I want to understand why you need to see something 6 times.
I just explained that.
I know. I don't like it.
Okay. Well,
I think it's weird. I think it's weird.
It's going to happen.
Yeah, I know. Every time I walk into the TV room, these two are watching Dune again. Really, you guys? Watch something new. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what, too? She's kind of into the dystopian films and dystopian storytelling. I think she's going to end up being a dystopian writer in the future.
She is such a good writer.
She's a good writer. So
incredible.
You know, she's into it, so I'm going to watch it with her. So I saw Dune Part 1. Loved it. I don't think it spent any time in the movie theaters its first time out. I think it was released right around the whole COVID thing, and they might have went straight to streaming if I remember correctly. This one had a wide release in the films in the theater, and we got IMAX tickets really early and saw this. And I got to tell you, it was visually incredible. The story was great. There was a little bit of wokeness here and there. But also there was a little bit of anti-wokeness in it as well at times. There was some religious overtones to it. They at times you kind of might feel like they might have been beating up on religion a little bit. But then there was also some redemption in that kind of approach. So I think it had a little bit of something for everybody. Incredible actors. Of course, it had Christopher Walken for the Emperor. It had Timothy Chalamet.
Mm-hmm.
He's the main character, Paul Atreides. Zendaya, who I felt like was the weak point in the film, if I'm being honest. She plays kind of his love interest.
I agreed.
Rebecca Ferguson.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. She plays Timothy Chalamet's mother. And then there's a cast of just all-stars.
Austin Butler, who was Elvis recently.
Josh Brolin. And as I mentioned, Christopher Walken. I think that this is something, you have to see this in the movie theaters. You have to see this, if possible, in the IMAX theaters. It is that good. It is the storytelling is amazing. I think the way that it kind of touches on kind of how power can kind of corrupt people. And there's a lot of common themes with contemporary world. And it's just overall just incredible storytelling. I'm giving this an enthusiastic ote for me. I think that you have to see Dune one before you see part one before you see this. And I think you could see that on HBO and you could just rent it or buy it yourself. But I'm saying Dune 2 is a big ote. You, Adriana?
You know, it's a visual smorgasbord, this movie. Visually, it's epic. And the story, you know, the book, so many other filmmakers have drawn from Dune. I don't know if Dune gets enough credit for that.
Yeah, Star Wars is one.
Yes, yes. Definitely an enthusiastic ote from me as well.
Ote from Adriana.
But you guys, I agree with Patrick. You have to see this in the theater because the sound, especially if you can go to IMAX. I mean, can you imagine seeing this at the Sphere?
Oh my God, that I would probably be like
you would be just, sobbing the whole time.
Sobbing the whole time. Yeah. It was incredible.
You would be weeping.
It makes me kind of feel like the movie theaters are back, and but I just don't want it to be for the big tent movies. I want it to be for you know, kind of those incredible character films as well too.
I don't know. I really like watching movies at home. I do. I like There's getting cozy that I like. On no, the couch with my like cozy that. Blanket.
But not Dune you know? 2. Dune Part
no,
2.
No, not
to see
not
that
a Dune.
Theaters.
Not a Dune. Okay, so let's move on to Red Right Hand, which yes. is the new movie by the Nelms brothers, yes. who we just spoke to.
Just spoke to. And I think
it stars
go ahead.
It stars Orlando Bloom, who is very, very fit in this movie. Ladies, you will enjoy it. Andy McDowell, who I love. I mean, when I think of Andy McDowell, I think of Groundhog's Day.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the beautiful young woman. And she's still a beautiful woman. And she does a really good job in this movie. And Garrett Dillahunt is in this.
He's the pastor in this film. And I thought that they really kind of handled, as we mentioned in our interview with the Nelms brothers, they handled religion in a different and unique way. I thought that was really well done. I'm giving this an enthusiastic ote. Check it out. If you're into, you have to be into kind of like that, you know, there's violence in it and gore, but it is with a purpose. It's a revenge flick. It's as simple as that.
It's a revenge flick. And I love it. This is my kind of film. I highly recommend it. So I'm giving it an enthusiastic ote as well.
So check that out, guys. So with that, do we have time? Let's make time for just one letter, if we could.
Okay.
In from the mailbag.
Read.
Let's see. I think.
Well, I have one that I want to read from my Substack, actually.
Go for it.
It's from Craig. Craig, thanks so much for your support on my Substack. He writes about a story that I wrote called Baby Beast. I love this story. I agree with Brian. This would make a fun RPA story similar to the Vicks Rape Vapor Rug story. At first, you had me choking back tears while you sat alone with the tea set and stuffed animal. But the payback at the end is classic Adriana. I've always wanted to own a little white house with a white picket fence. Hearing your story brought back some wonderful dreams of a young Craig. Your writings are terrific. Keep them coming, baby beast. That was really nice.
That was
and
really
made
nice.
Me feel very happy.
And
thank you very much.
From Patrick T, he said, "Hi, Patrick and Adriana. I've been wanting to tell you why I love you both so much. I have been an avid listener for a couple of years and a fan band member for about 3 months now. I have to say that you totally won me over on your Sound of Freedom episodes." Thanks for saying that, Patrick. "Anybody that would potentially end their podcast and potentially suffer a right-wing cancellation to get out the truth totally earns my lifetime trust, respect, and admiration. Please don't ever stop giving out the truth in such an entertaining manner. Thank you again, and God bless, Pat." Thank you for saying that.
That makes me a little misty-eyed.
Yeah, you know what? Me as well, too, but this is the second time I've read it, so I'm not going to let it get to me.
Yeah.
Finally, Earl S. He said, "Patrick, you turned me on to Scott Adams about a year ago. Thanks for doing this interview." We got a lot of that. A lot of people liked
this. Yeah, a lot of people really enjoyed that one.
Talking to Scott Adams. So with that, let's go to the parting shot. We have some other mail at the tail that I wanted to get to, but we're running out of time. We'll get to that next time. Let's go with our parting shot now. And close out this week's installation of Fam Boogie. So we I think, which one did we say we wanted to go with? Is this the one we said we
That's
wanted to
the
go
one.
With? Okay. This is kind of one of those feel-good videos that we thought we should get into. Thank you guys so much for sticking it out with us here at Fam Boogie. You guys now kind of have an understanding as to why we're doing this show. It's going to get better and better every week. We think it's important. We think it's important to push other people that are to push their content. People that are getting in the game, they need to have platforms to promote what it is that they're doing. And we hope to make another one similar to what we did with Red Pilled America. We're doing it with Fam Boogie. With that, we're going to leave you with this feel good video. Please, if you guys want to subscribe to Red Pilled America, go to redpilledamerica.com. Click join at the top of the menu. You'll become a Fam Bam member. We need you guys here. We need to, in order to make the alternative to Hollywood that we all want to see, because we all love watching great content, and we love being pulled into these stories and taken out of kind of the sometimes the misery of the day and be inspired. In order to create that ecosystem, you need to put your resources into that ecosystem. So we need you guys. RedPilledAmerica.com. Click join at the top of the menu. And with that, we're going to thank you guys for helping us save America one story at a time. And until next time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody. For those of you in audio, that was a man, a father showing his baby, his muscles. And his baby is trying to mimic him.
That's so cute.
Thank you guys so much for being here with us. And until next time.
Bye, everyone.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. This week, I talked to Orlando Bloom in a rare interview where we went deep into how to get comfortable with fear and how to change the guilt and shame thought pattern.
People say, what are you afraid of, right? I'm afraid of fear because it's like I want to confront anything in my life that feels challenging on those levels.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty. We're the Armstrong and Getty Show.
We cover the stories the mainstream media ignores.
Stories that are important to your life and important to the world.
The election, of course.
The many trials of Donald Trump.
Couple of wars.
Gender-bending madness.
Why are kids looking at so much social media?
And we bring you the stories the mainstream media is on.
But we do it without the left-wing media spin.
Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Open your free iHeart app and search the Armstrong and Getty Show to start listening.